The Living Clean podcast is not affiliated with Narcotics Anonymous, nor do we speak on behalf of NA as a whole. We are simply members sharing our personal experiences and perspectives in recovery-based discussions. The opinions expressed here are our own and not those of Narcotics Anonymous as a fellowship. This is the Living Clean podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. Okay, welcome back to the Living Clean podcast. I'm Mason S. I'm an addict. We are back for a very special episode. They're all very special. Well, who am I kidding? But we're excited about this one tonight. Before we get started, we're going to start with introductions. I'm going to kick it over to the co-host with the most, Francis.
I'm Francis. I'm an addict. Clean date is December 22nd, 1992, and my home group is You Are the Book Study, Chico, California.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go with Chase.
Yeah, I'm Chase. I'm an addict. Clean date, February 10th of 2020. Home group is the Dark Side of the Moon group in Homewall, Tennessee.
Thank you, Chase. Welcome back.
Man, glad to be back.
Also coming back for maybe the third or fourth time, Peter.
Peter, grateful recovering addict. My home group is You Are the Book, same as Francis, in Chico, California, and my clean date is August 18th, 2024.
Welcome back, Peter. And our guest tonight, John.
Yeah, John here. Really grateful to be with all of you. I'm an addict. My home group is Growing the NA Way. That's here in Carbondale, Colorado. Clean date is August 21st, 1984.
Awesome. Welcome, John. We're so glad to have you. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Oh, it's an honor.
All right. Well, Francis, why don't we start with you? Why don't you tell us the idea and the motivation for wanting to bring John on?
Well, we had did a couple of episodes we did an episode called God Walked In, and we came across a gentleman named Peter K. And he did an episode with us called Awe and Awe. We started a conversation with him, and he started talking about you. It was a side conversation. And he said that he did an 11-step retreat with you up in Auburn, California, which is in my region. And I just thought that you were an interesting character, and I did some research and I bought your book, and I saw your TED talk, and you do a daily meditation. So I'm like, wow, this guy, recovering addict, and a lot of different other things. I don't want to say it all right now because, we're about to go on a journey with you. But that's what prompted me to get a hold of you. Is I just kind of listen to other people say, this would be a good episode for you guys. You should check this out. And here we are.
Okay. So John, why don't you just take us back to the beginning, man? What happened? How did you end up in Narcotics Anonymous?
Yeah, well, sorry about that. My voice just went away. I am born and bred to be an addict. I actually come from a family of nine. My mom had nine children, four older brothers, all of which are addicts, all of which went to, through this addiction. I'm eight out of nine. And so, unfortunately, my dad died when I was very young, when I was six. So mom had to raise all nine of us. And so all my brothers, grew up and, shooting dope. I was... eating cereal with a burnt spoon when I was a little kid, and Now my mom, man, never gave up, man. She drug us to church. She wasn't giving up on us. She would stand up in court telling the judge he's got it wrong, you know, and my boys are good. And so it was this journey, you know, and you know, it was a lot of course, you know, what we would call adverse childhood experiences, right? You know, like 10 years old, I knew how to answer the door when the police came. You know, do you have a search warrant? No, you cannot come in. 10 years old, boosting liquor from the liquor store, selling it to high school kids, using it to anesthetize myself. You know, growing up, you know, in middle school, had drive-bys, you know, just showering our house with bullets, you know, and diving under the couch. And, you know, just, you know, the chaos that comes from that kind of life. You know, just the defenses, you know, and but somehow through it all, which is unusual, I was the first of the males in my family to graduate high school. I managed to graduate high school. And, you know, I was a drug dealer in high school, but I got through it. And, you know, but an interesting thing there in my senior year, like I knew when I turned 18, I'm going to jail. Everybody else went to jail. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, I want to change. I don't want to wind up like my brothers. I don't want to wind up in the penitentiary. I don't want to do that. And here's probably the core of everything else hopefully we'll talk about, is that deep down, I always wanted to be a good person. You know, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who didn't. You know, I mean, we're in this program a while. I've been around a little bit. I've never met another human being who did not want to be a good human being. I met a lot of human beings like me who didn't know how. You know, I didn't know how. I don't know how they did. I don't know. I remember looking out the window watching a family pack up a car and go on a picnic. And I used to wonder, how do they do that? Like, how do normal people live, you know? And so senior year, I'm like looking at it, man. And my thought, which was kind of odd, but maybe lays a groundwork for my life to come, is I thought, I want to join the priesthood. Like, you know, that's not what you would think from a drug dealer, you know, senior year and all that. But my mom always took us to church. It always felt safe. And I thought, when I turn, you know, when I graduate, I could join the priesthood, change my life, and they could finally teach me how to be a good human being. And I'll tell you what, that I hung on to that to get me through that last year with all the, you know, all the things I'd done, all the harm I had done, all the things and my shame and all that. I just thought that was going to do it for me. And when I graduated, I did interview for the priesthood, actually. There's a flaw in the plan. They actually have standards, and they don't just let dope fiend high schoolers join the priesthood, believe it or not. Apparently, they didn't think I was spiritually fit, which, you know, obviously they're right. So that plan went out the window. And I actually wound up, it's interesting, up near you, friends, I lived in Oroville. I moved up to Oroville, California. Yeah, talk about attic land, you know.
That's where I'm from. Graduated Oroville High School, 1985.
Very cool. So I was up there in 1980.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to move.
A lot of, we called it crank back then, but a lot of methamphetamine back then.
Yeah, and silly me, I was moving away to get out of addiction and all the, you know, the chaos of you know, Pasadena, California, LA area, and landed in Oroville, and actually met the mother of my daughter there. So, yeah, so that's, you know, the background journey, and you know, I would go on to, you know, move away, so I didn't go to jail like everybody else. I would continue to be an addict. I would meet a woman in Oroville who became the mother of my daughter. And, you know, we don't have time for the whole journey of all these things, but I would wind up eventually homeless, you know, raising two little boys with her, and she's just giving birth to my own daughter, and living in Colorado and in a homeless camp, and finally getting a little shed to live in. And, you know, and wanting to be a good dad. I, you know, I wanted to be a good dad. I didn't want, this stuff to happen. And I was poor enough to not be using every day. And it's interesting. I was actually a fairly decent human being. You know, I'd hitchhiked to work in a lumber yard, got us into a little place finally. But at one point I finally got a decent job, finally got a decent apartment, got us okay. My daughter was born. And, you know, what do I do when things are good? You know, I used, man, that was like the worst time of my life is in Ogden, Utah. And I would lose everything. And there's a story in, TED talking about that, about the night I lost my daughter, lost my family, the shame. And that didn't get me clean, it would be a year and a half later, it would be, having lost my daughter, lost my family, lost everything, any sense of self-worth, and then finally hurting just another human being one more time. But the thing that was different for me was I had actually taken the second step before the first step. Two of my brothers got clean, and I saw their life improve. Like, two of my brothers found NA, they started getting a life. I'm back home sleeping on my mom's couch, and I saw with my own eyes that people could be restored to sanity, that they could have a life, that they could do things. And, I wasn't ready, of course, because I still had my shit together sleeping on the couch. And, but then when that pain was great enough, in August of 84, I actually knew there's a place to go. And August 21st, 1984, the shame, the pain, the brutality of my low, got me to my first meeting. And so it was really, I didn't realize all that at the time. I had to look back, and the second step had happened. I knew there was a place, and I knew it worked, and I saw it with my own eyes. And so I made it to a meeting, and it's been quite a journey since then.
So you were aware of Narcotics Anonymous due to your brothers.
Yeah.
I find it so interesting that you say you took the second step first, because that's my experience.
Awesome.
My father, my sisters, they got clean before I did. And, I knew where to go and when I was ready. I just hoped that I would get that way. And it did happen, or we wouldn't be here. But that's so interesting to hear you say it in that way. I've never thought about it in those terms, but that's exactly the way that I felt. I did believe that people could get better because I seen it with my own eyes. That's what Second Step's all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it the recognition of sanity, or was it, you said you took this, you had the second step before you got here, but like, oh yeah, that's what sanity looks like. I should do that.
Yeah. It's like when I pictured looking at a family where they were doing things like normal human beings, I guess sanity, my brothers, were doing that. They were doing life. They had regular jobs. They had friends. They did fun things. My brother Mark joined a softball league, and I'm like, what? Sane, healthy, normal things and having fun, man, And that sanity was staring me in the eye that was possible.
Come on in, Chase.
Yeah, just jump in. I got a question for you, John. So they made it to the rooms before you did. How did they, because obviously, we've probably all been around people who had some recovery when we didn't, and we know what it's like for that to be forced on us. What was kind of the process? How did they let you find your way into that, or what motivation, or what did that look like?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because my brothers didn't 12-step me, right? They were examples, right? They were examples. And actually, they had, they'd done, some time and, they'd been through some things. So I was younger. I was like 5 and 8 years younger. And, And so one of them, actually, my brother, who still has a little more time than me, he almost tried to talk me out of it. Like he's like, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Because once you stop using, it changes, and he actually had made amends to me for for that conversation. And because I didn't go do hard time, I did some jail time, but I'd never done that next thing. And so it was much more of them just being an example, checking in on me. And then when I was ready, it was interesting. One of my brothers was actually said, "Are you sure?" And it was funny to watch him make an amends years later about that. He was still early in his recovery.
What's so when you get to NA, you finally hit your first meeting. What's some of your first some of your first thoughts about it and the way the program was laid out or the people?
So for me, it was terrifying. It was awful. It was, I mean, I didn't go in there and it was all rainbows and unicorns, man. It was like I was beat down. I was miserable. I didn't, it was, this or die. It was, the rest of, my life's over pretty much. And I just want to somehow not feel this shame. I want to somehow maybe look in the mirror, somehow find a way to be okay. And I didn't know how to talk to people. I mean, I was, some of you may have seen a show called Dexter, the guy, a sociopath who's a killer, right, in Syria. I was
Was
like
that
him. I was
was
so,
that was based on you?
I felt like that guy. I was totally anesthetized and from my body feelings, and I didn't know how normal people lived. I wasn't relating to emotions. And kind of like Dexter would have this voice, like a normal person, you should say this, you should do this. And much of my first year was that. Much of my first year was sitting in the back of the room by the door, where I slip out, get a cigarette, and uncomfortable. And back then, meetings were 8:30 to 10 usually. So it was 8:30, you open it up, have a little speaker, 10-minute break, get back, have a meeting. And that was the standard back in those days. And that 10-minute break was freaking torture, man. Like people are mingling and talking to each other and hugging. And I don't even play that hugging shit. Like, back up, Holmes. They'd be nice to me and maybe bring me a cup of coffee. I was so sick that I didn't want to use the bathroom because I think maybe they think I'm using or whatever. Like, it was just that bad, that chaos. And one of my best friends used to say, "Some are sicker than others, and then there's John." And like it was awkward, it was uncomfortable, but I saw people living life. I saw people doing healthy things. I didn't know how to speak to them. I didn't, my whole conversation for my first 3 months is I didn't use today. After that, I really didn't have a lot of commentary. And it was awkward and uncomfortable. And 3 months in, they invited me to an after meeting party. And a couple people knew my brother. So I thought, okay, it's cool. I can go to that. And I went to this party, and these people were talking about life. They were like, somebody was going to Saudi Arabia, someone else was doing this other thing. Some they all had these lives, and I'm on this couch and I'm paralyzed with fear. Like, I don't have anything to contribute. I've already shared that I have 3 months clean, and that's the rest of my conversation. And I didn't want to go to the bathroom just because I couldn't even ask where it was, and I didn't want to leave because people would notice I'm like. For like, it was like 2 hours of torture. I was that insecure, that uncomfortable. Be around people who knew how to live. So I didn't know how to talk. I was, really disassociated. I just wanted to try to do whatever I'm supposed to do. And I remember at one point, about 6 months in, with everybody laughing, having a good time, thinking, you know, when I get a year, I'm going to tell these assholes what I think. But right now I'm scared, so I'm not going to say anything. And then when I got a year, I hugged everybody in that room and told them, thank you for saving my life, man. Thank you for saving my life. So I really came in pretty sick, pretty uncomfortable, shame-based. And but I went to meetings every day, and I didn't go to treatment. And, you know, and I sat on my hands at midnight, you know, to, can I go to sleep? And these people would welcome me, and eventually coffee commitment, you know, and all that stuff. But what they taught me in my first year, and this is what would transform my life probably more than anything else I've ever done, is they taught me the most important question. Right? So the whole life that I've had, I've been asking the wrong question. The wrong question is, you know, what can I do to feel good? Right. And I think we all ask that, even if you're not an addict, you know, what's good for breakfast? What was good to do today? You know, what can I do to feel good? And they taught me to ask, how can I be helpful? That question changes everything. When I started asking that question, how can I be helpful, even when I'm uncomfortable, a really unusual thing happened to me. I started feeling helpful. Wow, like I hadn't felt helpful, you know, and I can't remember feeling helpful. And by asking that question, how can I be helpful, I start becoming helpful. And, you know, that led me to my first little job delivering auto parts. And then how can I be helpful? And that would lead me to, at one point, becoming a manager of the auto parts store. And, you know, like, you know, I wanted to be a good employee. I wanted to help the clients. I wanted to be helpful. And they even gave me the combo to the safe, man. I was like, what? You know, I mean, I remember calling my brothers, man. They gave me a combination of the safe. Like, they don't know who I am. And my brother said, no, they know who you are today. You know, they know who you are today. And, you know, that question of how can I be helpful, that's, I think, you know, I just came from my NA meeting home group about self-respect, about integrity, you know, and that's coming from doing things we feel good about, not doing things to make us feel good, right? You know, that's the journey of self-worth. That's the journey of recovery. And then that led me from, you know, friend of mine thought it'd be good working with adolescents in treatment. I was a mechanic. I became a mechanic. Then I worked with adolescents in treatment. Just how can I be helpful? I didn't have any training. They taught me. Turned out to be good. Asking that question then led me to, from counseling to, I became a high school teacher. I got to teach inner city high school, North Long Beach Compton, kicking it with the homies. And, you know, like Mr. Bruna, you, here's your classroom. You're decorating your classroom. Like, really? You know, I mean, I remember being at NAME once, and this woman shared she was getting a master's degree. And I was like, what? Addicts getting master's degrees? Like, who does that? Like, what? Like, you know, I couldn't even wrap my head around that. And, you know, how in the world would I one day, like, be a school teacher, you know? And man, thought I would do that for the rest of my life. It was such a good gig, and you know, really enjoyed doing that. And then one day, you know, again asking this question, it would lead me, and there's other stories we can get to of the suffering and pain I went through that would lead me to meditation and so forth. But eventually a Buddhist monk, you know, and school teacher, Buddhist monk, counselor, you know, here I am, you know, meeting the Dalai Lama, running an event. Like, you know, how'd that happen? What happens because, and by the way, that's the short version of the third step. How can I be helpful? Right. And, you know, it's also when praying only knowledge for God's will for me and the power to carry that out, what would God want you to do? I think he'd want you to be helpful. You know, I call it the short version of the St. Francis prayer, you know? Where there's this, may I be this. You get to, in whatever situation, whatever environment, whatever's coming up, how can I be helpful? And so that's carried on now 40 years, and that led me, yeah, Buddhist monastic. It's led me to the journey I'm on now. And yeah, it hasn't always been rosy. It's had some
What bumps. Years were you teaching high school in Compton?
Actually, it was North Long Beach, right on the border of Compton. So Jordan High School, North Shore. It's right down the from Death Row Records, actually.
Is it Snoop Dogg from Long Beach?
Snoop Dogg did go to our school briefly. He mostly went to the other school on Atlantic. But yeah, he got kicked out, believe it or not. He wasn't very academically inclined. So I think he lasted about 3 months at Jordan. But I taught from like at Jordan High School from 2000 to 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, I taught Sylmar year before that, which is in the San Fernando Valley.
Wow. So as you're transitioning through these different jobs with this mindset of how can I be helpful, do you feel like you were following a path, or what was the feeling that would come on that would be like, okay, it's time to move on and transition from the auto parts store into this other journey? Like, how did you have the confidence to take that step? Because I feel like so many people are meant to do different things, but they're just stuck in that fear of chasing that dream.
Yeah, it's interesting. Early on in my recovery, you know, back in, you know, the 80s, you know, there was a lot of mixture between AA and NA, and there was an old AA book called A New Pair of Glasses that I read. And Chuck Sees, the guy who wrote it, and he had this whole section on doing your job, doing life for fun and for free. In other words, not being transactional. And what the gist was, do not show up to work for a paycheck. Show up to work because that's what you're here to do, to be helpful. And so I had this mindset that the day that I showed up to work for a paycheck would be the day I quit. That if I'm delivering auto parts, it has to be meaningful. I want to get the right part. If I'm an auto parts person, I want to make sure when I'm the manager, I want to take care of things. I became an auto mechanic. I want to make sure I put your tires on right. I want to make sure the brakes work. And so it was meaningful and it was purposeful. And but with a third step, you know, when you think about God's will, is it's like, always being in tune to this question is, you know, people get confused about God's will, which I think it's pretty much what's happening. not rocket science. In this situation, what's most beneficial? And so, you know, as things open up, as people, you know, come together and things ripen, you know, this constant state of the 11th step was by in early years and today to this day, 11th step was my most practiced step. And praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. That was my primary prayer. I wasn't praying for this or for that or, you know, what's God. So hearing that frequently and wanting to do life in a meaningful way is what would allow me to be open. And I was, you know, when they said you should work with adolescents, he was my best friend. We got clean together. And now, if you'd have thought that I'd be good working with adolescents in treatment, I was an auto mechanic, and my idea of fun was shooting a blowtorch underneath the bathroom stall when you're taking a dump. Like, you know, you shouldn't leave me alone with adolescents, you know, and you know, kind of a blue collar guy. Got a decent program, good human being, trying to be helpful, but, you know, I wasn't well-cultured, you know, in many ways. And I had to learn how to tie a tie to go to the job interview with a psychiatrist at a really prestigious hospital in Burbank, California. And, you know, clip-on tie wouldn't do.
I have to use a YouTube instruction on how to tie a tie at work once a month for when I have to go to court for my clients. But, like, I got you. The wins are not.
The wins are not. It's not an easy deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that is the best one.
Yeah, you said something very interesting about God's will. I thought that was great. It's just kind of what's happening. And so is the third step about me coming to terms with that?
Yeah, I think the third step is stop resisting reality.
Yeah.
The weird thing is, I think that this situation should be different than it is. Like, you know, just saying that out loud, you could see it's insane. How do I know how it should be? Like, I don't even know who's going to call me tomorrow. And I think I know how people should act, how the world should be, you know, that Jill Miller should not have freaking dumped me. I was pretty sure that was not, you know, the right thing. and you sit there and you go, these things are unfolding. You know, if Jill Miller hadn't dumped me, you know, would I have ever been a Buddhist monk? Would I have, you know, had this other part of my dream? Would I be married to the woman I'm married to today? You know, no, right? There's this whole thing that's unfolding that I have no power over. And, you know, my job isn't to control that. My job is to learn from it and understand that what's happening to me is happening for me. Like, there's not a single event I could have ever found in my life that is not an opportunity to grow, to improve, or to help, be helpful. And some of them are really hard, and some are really wonderful. Most are fairly mundane. But if I'm in tune with, in any event, how can I be helpful in this situation? You know, God's will has just given me the journey. And so that gave me strength, right? So I went in with, how can I be helpful? I was just a tech on an adolescent unit. Eventually, I would run an 80 resident adolescent facility in Van Nuys. You know, so it just kept pushing me. It got me to UCLA, got me my counseling credential back in 1991, I think. And, you know, and I thought, wow, I went to UCLA, I have a credential, like, you know, mind blowing stuff. And, you know, and then, you know, I never thought I could do any of these things. And here's the thing, if I actually left to my will, you know, I mean, I would not have taken any of these steps, right? So I think that was the gist of your question. How do we remain open? And for me, it's always been the 11th step. You know, what's God's will for me today? Does he want me to hide and stay safe here? Does he want me to be helpful? And then, you know, I mean, I was in the fourth row at a Dalai Lama teaching in 2004. 2006, I'm a Buddhist monk. I am running that whole teaching with 3,000 participants in the same hall in Pasadena, California, and organizing a 7,000 person event at Universal. It was Universal Amphitheater back then. And meeting the Dalai Lama. So 2004, I'm just sitting there like a guy in the fourth row. A year later, I'm ordained. A year later, they asked me to be the coordinator. 2 years apart, just a regular school teacher sitting in the row. 2 years later, I'm meeting His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, running the event as a Buddhist monk. And I generally tell people, be careful when you go to a teaching, you might get a haircut and learn how to wear a dress. You know, like you just don't know, right? So for me to sit here and think I know what should happen, you know, I'm just going to teach and think, when would I ever get ahead? You know, this is remarkable. And, you know, we don't know. If you listen to people in our meetings, there's a journey that comes that, you know, nobody imagined. And so the third step, sitting here thinking, my will showed up. Man, you know, none of this is going to happen.
So there's my will. And then there's God's will, and then there's free will. And I know that you've done something on free will. It's free will is a skill, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because this is something that I've always found fascinating. You know, it's, you know, and there's a big, you know, discussion on, you know, from a Christian perspective, Judeo-Christian, you know, we suffer because we have free will. Right? We make poor choices, and we're free to make those poor choices. And then there's a whole other thing that you'll see, evolutionary and so forth, that saying you don't really have free will. You have been conditioned, and you know, due to your conditions and habits and so forth, you're kind of gonna do this and that, and you don't really have free will. And any of us who've been addicted know that you can feel like you have no free will at all, right? I'm trying to quit, but I can't. And today, even, we can feel like, hey, I'm gonna be happy today, and you're not, right? Like, you know, you kind of notice, whoa, I don't have so much free will. And then, you know, the point I make is we suffer because we don't have much free will. That, and sort of this my will, God's will thing is funny, because what you really start to realize is what you label your will. Nah, that's not you. That's a bunch of habits, a bunch of conditioning, a bunch of fears, a bunch of insecurities. And here, you want an easy way to align your will and God's will and be connected? I could teach you that in 2 minutes. It's never failed. So next podcast, we'll do it, okay?
Well, we have 2 minutes right now.
Yeah, no, it's just messing with
you. We're in the present.
Yeah, here we go. No, so it's this simple. As so, you know, you take a few breaths. So here's something I don't know what to do, or I'm ruminating on something I didn't do well, or you know what's coming up, right? As you take a few breaths, use ground, and you take a moment, and you know, bring the situation, and then you ask as sincerely as possible this question. In this situation, objectively, what would be a healthy thing to do? Okay, not what should I do, not what's the right thing to do. You got to get your ego entirely out. It's objectively, in this situation, objective, you don't have to do it, objectively, what would be a healthy thing to do? And you will get an incredibly solid answer. Where'd that answer come from? Where did that answer come from? Because you stepped out of the way and you just asked in this situation, what's a healthy thing to do? If it's asked sincerely, you know, without an attachment to what you should do, you're going to get a really solid answer. I've done this with people in 1 week in recovery, and they get a good answer. We kind of know if we take a moment what would be a healthy thing to do. And this came to me once. It was actually a guy I had sponsored previously who called me. He's in a lot of pain. He's talking and he's telling me his struggles. And he told me, I don't know what to do. And it just hit me. It hit me like a lightning bolt. It said, you know, that's not true. It's just not true. You know, in my mind, I heard that. And I said, let's take a few breaths. And I said, what would be a healthy thing to do? And he had his freaking answer. Now, whether or not you can do it, that's a whole different story, right? But there's clarity there. Now, the free will is to be able to act on the answer. So first, we need to be able to listen. And what's it like to know that you have a guiding, dear friend with you at all times, always available, always there for you? But we don't know how to ask the question, and we don't listen, because my ego, who's not my amigo, is like running the show, man. And he thinks Jill Miller should not dump me. I'm just still on that, you know. She finally called me after 20 years. Too late, man. No, she's a wonderful human being. We're dear friends now. But you know, I just sit there and think about emotional pain. And in those moments of pain, we think we're losing something when in fact something is unfolding for us, right? Mm. And but we always have that available voice if we train, you know, on how to listen to it. And but we need to get the ego out of the way. You know, I kind of think of my ego as this little maniac 16-year-old who's like, you know, got a lot of cool ideas about what we should do, most of which would get me in jail. And he's trying to tell me it's worth it. And, you know, I don't want him running my world. You know, but we think that's our will. That's not our will. That's our fears, that's our insecurities, and that's our conditioning. That's our survival, that's our armor. That's not our will. Your will, if you want to know, it's easy. You could write down 5 things that you know you could do to improve your life. And I'm pretty sure they'll be healthy things, and they'll probably align with God's will. It's, you know. So we confuse our will with our fears, our insecurities, our identification with ego, our, you know, because that's, you know, ego is really about protecting itself and its image, worrying what other people think about you and what I'm good at, what I'm not good at, you know, and all that stuff. And that's not your will, you know. Your will is when you get quiet and you listen and you, you know, who do you want to be? How do you want to show up, you know? And the problem is it's very difficult to act on that. So that TED talk on free will is the skill of learning to take action on being the person you want to be, the person of value, the person that you feel good about being, doing things you feel good about, which is a skill we need to learn because that ego is very pernicious, right? You know, when they call it the committee and, you know, all that, the addiction talking to you. You know, now that's you, man.
You were.
Go ahead, Francis. Okay. I was curious. You talked about being in the fourth row at the seminar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What happened that day? What happened to you that day that led you down that path of what was to come, what you shared earlier?
Yeah, so, you know, to put me in that chair, I'd already been exploring Buddhism. As you know, what had happened is I had had a divorce, and really that's what initiated this next sort of journey. I had about 15 years clean, and my world fell apart, you know, and you know, divorce, and I found out some things that I had no idea about, you know, and I felt like there, my life had become a Jerry Springer show that I was unaware of, and it was painful. I was really depressed. I went into a depression, and you know, I was a single dad with my daughter, and that's the time when I decided I want to do all the things they tell you to do in your first year. You know, like don't get in a relationship, you know, work the steps, get a good relationship with yourself, you know, and all that. You know, I mean, to be honest with you, my first year, I mean, not that anyone would date me anyway because I was so sick, but like I didn't know what a men's meeting was, you know, like who would go to a men's meeting? There's no women there. Like, you know, just, you know, the whole thing was weird that people would do things like that. And, you know, and I'm so anyway, I went through this divorce and I'm like, I've never really been alone. I've never really been with myself. And I wanted to learn what it was like to have a relationship with myself and to not need someone to make me okay. And so I took a year of celibacy, like, you know, real celibacy, not even self-gratification. I made a commitment to work the steps, go back to basics, to learn to meditate. And that's where I learned to meditate formally. And, you know, as a single dad, I'm just going to be a single dad. And it was the first 3 months were the toughest things in the world, you know, like to not do all these, you know, things to, and be uncomfortable. And but I learned to meditate and I was focusing on being a good dad and I was going through the steps all back to basics. And this, by the celibacy, by the not seeing, you know, who do I want to date or what do I need or all that desire. And meditating and working, you know, working with others, sponsoring the stuff we do. About 6 months into that, this incredible thing happened. And that was, I was able to have healthy, intimate relationships with human beings. In other words, I wasn't gauging anyone by how they looked, what they had to offer me, I wasn't comparing. I just saw this incredible wholeness of recovery, that I have this life and I have this daughter, and people, whether they're attractive, not attractive, they're human beings that help me learn how to live, and I get to be helpful. And by the end of the year, you know, that comfort in your own skin thing was happening, that, you know, and I was wrapping up getting my teaching credential, and I moved to Long Beach to teach down there. But so that was all preconditioning. I found a Buddhist center, started going to it, to go to the Dalai Lama. So when I'm sitting there, I'd already gone through this incredible transformation, back to basics with the steps, and you know, being okay in my own skin, not needing someone. As a matter of fact, the reason I use the word intimacy is because I never felt alone. I was single and was more connected than I'd ever been in my life. I wasn't lonely for anything. I was okay with me, and I had lots of friends. This recovery program's amazing. There's colleagues, there's, and my daughter, you know, getting her off to college. Like, there was no loneliness and no need, you know. It was gratitude. It was amazing. And so when I went to that teaching that day, you know, I'd already been meditating, I'd already been learning. And then, you know, I see all the monks and nuns on stage. And, you know, my daughter's going to college. You know, do I buy into this stuff? Is it good for me? And the thought came, you know, could you be a monk, you know? Like, you know, if you're into this. And so that seed was planted. And, you know, fourth row, Dalai Lama was like looking at me because I was right behind his translator. So he's talking to him, you know, so like he's just brainwashed me for 3 days. And, you know, it's like, you know, boom. And the other interesting thing that preceded this was some monks had come to town. I went to all their teachings, and one of them just lit me up, man. And it got me so inspired. You know, he talked about how we could want the best for every being, you know, whatever we do, you know, just this way. And you just saw he meant it. And, you know, and then I was all fired up, you know, and I go out to talk to a monk at their little table where they sell stuff. I'm like trying to, you know, he didn't speak English. He knew how to take my money though and sold me a mala. And, you know, I was like, okay, I got a mala out of the deal. And then I go talk to a Western monk who's in the parking lot, who's driving them around the country. And he said that teacher you've been going to, he's one of the greatest ones in our whole tradition, volunteer there. Go and hang out, be of service. So I was doing that, going to meetings, being a school teacher. And then the Dalai Lama happened. So all this was happening. And then, you know, I talked to one of the nuns, and she said, if you're really thinking about being a monk, go ask, you can talk to him. You know, he doesn't say yes very often. It's pretty rare. You know, Westerners get all excited, you know, but so anyway, I go in, I ask him, you know, and he's, you know, but me, cause you know, I'm an addict. I know how to work things. I got angles. I'm not going to ask him, should I be a monk or can I be a monk? I'm saying, if I can be a monk in 3 years, you know, what should I do? I just want some advice, you know, because that way he could look at me and say, don't waste your time, you're a knucklehead. Or he might inspire me and say, yeah, do these things, we'll talk, you know. And so I go in there, you know, I do my little prostrate and sit down. And he looks at me, yeah, you want to be a monk? Oh, yeah, you know. And he said, good, you're ready. I'll take you to India next year. And I'm like, yeah, wait a minute. You know, I got this 3-year deal. And he laughed at me. And then he looked at me. And he told me about myself. He told me why I'm ready. Like it's like he's looking at my mind and told me all about me and specific things that tell me why I'm ready to be a Buddhist monk. And then he pointed out what I needed to work on, and he was nailing it. And I was like, I just felt naked, man. I'm like, you know, and it was like, what? And he said, it'll be fine. You go to India, get your robes, come back. You'll teach a couple more years. It'll be good. And so I went to India, got ordained, and guess what? when you're in the monastery, 1500 monks, they assign you a teacher who's your caretaker, who's your guide in this whole journey. It was the monk who years earlier gave the talk in Long Beach.
Wow.
Becomes my teacher. I come back from India and there's a little round jolly monk who needs a room. He's the monk who sold me the mala. And he becomes my roommate in my house for the next bunch of years. And then the Western monk in the parking lot, well, they gave me his job and I would be driving the monks around. So they set me up basically years earlier. And then when I got back, they said, we would like you to coordinate the teaching of the Dalai Lama. And so the next year was preparing for that trip. So, you know, it's like you talk about things unfolding. You know, you don't know when you're at this event or that thing, the ripple effects and what will unfold for our journey. When we're asking that question, right? How can I be helpful? When we're asking, you know, why am I here? And in that 11th step, so the meditation is what gave me, you know, that the capacity to pay attention to that guidance. And so 11th step has always been near and dear to my heart. And my real core belief is, you know, not to take a third step, but to live a third step.
Yeah.
Because when we're living a third step, you don't have any issues. You know, how can you be stressed if, you know, I get stressed and my little insecure ego wants to do shit and doesn't want you to do shit and wants, you know, my life to look like that. And man, imagine if I had to listen to that little guy, you know, none of this would be happening.
Right before you logged in, Chase and I were talking a little bit about this thing called two-way prayer, which is a practice that they were doing in the Oxford group. And you know, like Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, and you know, like, and basically it's just the 11th step. And you're like, you're boiling down the whole thing to how can I be helpful? You know, like praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out is, yeah, how can I be helpful? You know, like, what is it? How can I serve you? You know, like, so yes, the third step, but yes, the 11th step too. You know, like, but the listening, you know, like the meditation and the prayer, but the, you know, what is it that we're asking God for? You know, like, and in the end, it's just how can I be helpful? How can I serve? Which is the 12th step.
Right. And, but the problem is, our minds are so scattered and busy, man. Like we can't listen, you know, we can't listen. We're not doing that. And, you know, now with, you know, the science that we now know and dopamine that gets hit through our cell phones, through our Facebooks, through our social media, through, you know, dopamine on demand, you know, entertainment at our fingertips, you know, it's, you know, there was a time, some of you may know, depending on your age, we didn't have answering machines, man. Like if somebody called you and you weren't home, you didn't know it. And even when you finally got answering machine, somebody called, you know, you didn't get a check and see it's Jimmy. You don't want to talk to that guy. You had to buck up and answer the phone, say hello, you know, like, you know, and you wanted to answer the phone. And I say that because there was a world that we lived in where people had monkey minds, that when you went home from work, you were home from work. Nobody's texting you. Nobody's emailing you. Nobody's doing that. People had dinner together. People would show up at your house that you didn't expect. Your neighbors, your friends, hey, in the neighborhood, what's going on? They usually do it around dinner time too. You know, and it's like, hey, come on, we're about to eat. And think they about
could,
the last.
They could ahead. They could smell Mason barbecuing is what's happening there.
That's right, man. Hey, I got it going on. Let's pop in. You know, and so you think about a world where you once went home and after five, nobody's contacted. There's no work. There's no, you're talking with the neighbors. Maybe you go to meetings, you go out to coffee, you know, and the way we communicated, the way we connected, the way we read actual books, Look at the world we're living in now, man. You know, we're in a bullet point world, man. Give me the nutshell, ChatGPT, give me the short answer. I'm a little bored, let me scroll YouTube, man. They have some pretty cool, funny cat videos, just saying. And, like we don't know how to be with ourselves anymore. And there's a whole book called Dopamine Nation that really talks how that actually puts us in dopamine deficit, which means, you know, we're uncomfortable unless we're getting stimulus and we're seeking it. And so try to take that mind and listen to your higher power, man, you know, and it's hard.
It's well, it's just that the term mindfulness is fairly new, you know, like, and almost, you know, like everything, there was a lot of mindfulness back then when we didn't have all the devices. And, but you're like, so when we got all the devices, you're like, we're trying to return to a time where we aren't so distracted by everything, you know, like, and so I think that's when, you know, like, I don't know, you know, like I used to go to the bathroom without a phone, you know, like right. that was mindfulness, you know, yeah. Like everything was mindfulness. So, but that's not what we called it back then. You know, like it was just, you know, like our life.
Yeah. Well, you were naturally more aware of what you're doing and because you weren't distracted all the time. And, you know, I think our text is about, you know, 24 hours, right? Day at a time, man. Like the book is a mindfulness book. Right. And, so we, you know, today, which, and here's the real issue that, you know, is kind of scary to think about, but we're on a podcast, might as well scare the shit out of you. So, our human kind of experience currently, I think we've all heard the term, you know, virtue is its own reward, right? Virtue is its own reward. And we go back to, you know, the Greeks. You're talking about virtue, talk about eudaimonia, you know, inner flourishing, well-being. I translate that, you know, doing things you feel good about, you know, living in alignment with your values. You feel good, you get self-respect. It's in our literature, you know, it's how we service. Well, we now take what is virtuous activity and we turn it into work and we turn it into chores. And so doing that next healthy thing or that next right thing or going to work or, you know, folding laundry, you know, like we call folding laundry a chore, which is interesting. A chore is an unpleasant but necessary task. Who wants to do an unpleasant but necessary task, you know? But when you're folding the laundry, you know what you're doing is you are contributing to the life you've always wanted to live. Right. In my case, with my partner, I'm being a good husband. I value being a good husband and a good partner. I'm folding the laundry. That's an alignment with my values. That's helping me be the kind of husband I want to be. It's contributing to life I've always wanted. I have clothes that are clean. She has clothes that are clean. You know, this is an incredibly miraculous life. And I'll think of that as a chore. And then going to work's a chore. And so what happens is we do all these chores and instead of patting ourselves on the back, feeling good about what we've done, we don't give ourselves a reward. That's just what we do. I mean, when someone compliments you, what do you say? You know, that's just what we do. When's the last time you let yourself just take a fucking compliment? Excuse my language. I don't know if you have to bleep that out.
No.
Okay, when's the last time you had to take a compliment? And it's hard. And then here's the scary thing. So now we take our virtue, we turn it into a chore, and then where's your reward? Well, my reward is I'm burnt out and I'm tired, so now I'm gonna get scrolling and get distracted and do all these things. So my reward becomes an unhealthy activity that undermines my ability to engage in virtue. And then when I feel good about doing the virtue, and then I do that, and then I'm burnt out, and then I seek distraction to be okay. And so there's this incredibly difficult loop that we get caught up in where the reward is undermining our well-being. Instead of recognizing that going to work is giving you the life you want, it's able to pay the bills. It's, we used to want to have a job, that I get to do these things. I get to help people. Why would that be tiring? It's tiring because we call it work. It's tiring because of the way I'm perceiving it. And, there's almost no job. I mean, chore at a job that's really painful other than my resistance to doing it. I work with a lot of counselors. Counselors, I have to do all this charting. And I'm like, well, what's hard about charting? What do you got to do? You got to sit down? Okay, that's hard. Okay, you sit down. Okay, you have to push the keyboard and you have to, those little buttons. Is that hard? No, I can do that. And you put words on a computer. Is that hard? No, that's not hard. Well, what makes it hard? Well, I don't want to do it. And you sit there and, I remember charting early days, 1990s, we actually had charts, those big ones at a hospital that they used to clip. You'd write down. I remember, man, I was learning like fancy words, man. Like client was mood labile. That means your mood goes up and down a lot. And I'm like, mood labile, man. Look at that. I'd be throwing down these fancy words. I was like having fun charting. 2 months later, I'm like, man, I have to do all these charts. Like, this is work. The only thing that changed was me. Right? And so we start realizing that so much of our stress, worry, fear, angst isn't really about what we're doing. And it's in our mind, seeking entertainment, seeking distraction, thinking things should be different than they are, and not recognizing that what you are doing is contributing to life you've always wanted. And if it's not, don't do it. Why are you doing it? If it's not meaningful, why are you doing it? And if you're doing it, why not make it meaningful?
Shots fired on the charts.
Yeah, I'm feeling personally attacked right now. I believe me and Nathan have that conversation about 20 times a week.
I hope my boss isn't hearing this.
They're going, yes, it's your resistance. But it's so true. It's so true. I remember the first time I did a chart, I thought it was the coolest thing just to be able to be considered worthy of doing a chart. Just to think where you came from and now you are interpreting what another person is going through and somebody has granted you the ability to do that. It's so cool. And then fast forward a couple of years and it, like you said, it feels like pulling teeth sometimes, but what changed? The charting didn't change.
No. As a matter of fact, you're more capable of doing it now than you were.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So we have all these things that, habitually we don't question the labels and now with distraction so on demand, it's amazing, how we can, there's a book, Dopamine Nation, I think most people should read. It breaks down the science of how we have dopamine on demand at our fingertips. A nation, not even acts, just who are getting addicted and who suffer from a dopamine deficits. So making time for ourselves, making time, actually doing things that are difficult will give you a greater sense of well-being for longer periods of time.
Even like folding the laundry, you made that point a minute ago. So resistant to do that, but every time that you do it and you do a good job and everything's clean and everything's up, you feel a sense of accomplishment. You feel good about the work that you've done. I wonder why that's not motivation enough to want to do it again.
It's a chore, man. Who wants to do the chores?
Or dishes, I used to like go into people's houses and do dishes for them, but it's always a struggle to do my own dishes. But but I always felt like it was like good service to, if you go over to somebody's house and they have some dishes, is just do the dishes for them because it's a pain in the ass to do your own dishes.
Yeah, and now you're describing our wonderful addiction disease, how we will do so many things for other people that we won't do for ourselves.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Now you, what about happiness, the habits of happiness? Is that what we were talking about? Is like getting into the habit of being happy about what we have to do instead of.
Yeah, well, and the key to genuine, what we call genuine happiness, is understanding the difference between short-term stimulus-driven pleasure, right? We think of that as happiness, you know, just had a nice meal, you know, I got my favorite dessert, feels good, I'm happy, right? Nice vacation, you know, I'm at this, you know, place and, you know, I'm happy, right? Got some good news, I'm happy. And that's actually usually just a very short-term stimulus, right? The vacation, the food, the information, somebody doing something. I get a feeling of pleasure. And we'll notice that that feeling of pleasure doesn't last very long, right? It'll come and it will go, you know. And, you know, likewise, our suffering doesn't generally last. That'll come and go. Actually, emotions don't last very long. Unless we trigger them and keep thinking about them, ruminate them, then we keep them going. But generally, almost any emotion will come and go very, very quickly. Unless we keep them alive, there's 9 ways to trigger an emotion, maintain it. But genuine happiness, well, we're using that term, it's not always a tense feeling of pleasure. It's actually more to do with what the Greeks call eudaimonia, inner flourishing. Self-worth, right? Value, that you feel good about who you are, and resiliency builds from that. You're competent, your life has meaning, you know, you're about something. And so this genuine happiness label, and the cause for genuine happiness is doing things you feel good about, right? Not just the things that make you feel good. And so when we talk about that, then we start recognizing if I want to be genuinely happy, I'm going to do a lot of the things that don't feel good, that I'll feel good about. And I'll do some things that feel good, that I feel good about. And what we start to realize, it almost doesn't matter what you're doing anymore. So, for example, if I have my, you know, I put in my book, right, an analogy was, if I'm having friends over for dinner and I want to impress them with my culinary, you know, expertise and, you know, what I can cook or show off my house and have them over and have this meal, well, my motivation is what? You know, it's to impress them, to make them like me, to see what a good cook I am, what a nice house. None of that's going to contribute to genuine happiness or a sense of self-worth. I'm seeking validation. My motivations are off. I'm not really thinking about them at all. But if I have them over because I want to feed my friends, because, you know, I want to hear about their life, because I want to really provide a nice time for them, now it's a whole different motivation for the same activity. One of them will build insecurity and grasping for validation, and one of them will create self-worth and value. And so genuine happiness is really about why we're doing what we're doing. You know, when my mom passed away, you know, my mom raised, like I said, 9 of us. My 4 older brothers got clean and me. So 5 of us, right? And when my mom was passing away, we were all there, my whole family. And we were able to tell my mom, it's okay to go, Mom. We're okay. You know, you don't have to worry about us anymore. You know, and there's probably, you know, I can't, you know, what a meaningful gift of recovery to let your mom know that she doesn't need to worry about you guys anymore. That you can go, your work is done. And we were all clean. And that was a sad moment, but was also one of the moments of genuine happiness in my life. Because, you know, how rare an opportunity that is. And so genuine happiness arises not simply from, if I can take a vacation in Hawaii, you know, is it about the vacation or is it about who I'm with, how I engage with the vacation, how I earn the vacation? Or is it all about getting a nice dinner, going to that beach, doing that thing? You know, so the everything we do, we could actually be cultivating genuine happiness, whether it's raking the yard, folding the clothes, being in Hawaii, having friends over. Or we could be seeking validation, stimulus-driven pleasure, trying to impress people, chasing what we call the eight worldly concerns, you know, praise and, you know, acceptance and these types of things. Or I can be helpful, a part of something, you know, doing something that's meaningful. And one of them will contribute to what we call genuine happiness. And the thing about genuine happiness, it's there even when you're sad. It's there even when difficult times come. It helps you bounce back. It says, yeah, this sucks, but it's okay. This is difficult. Yeah, but we're going to get through it. But chasing the tent, go ahead.
Is that equanimity?
Equanimity would be a clear example of that. Yeah, you would have a state of equanimity when you really are okay with yourself and your purpose and your connection with your values in life. You're going to have a lot of equanimity. Yeah. You don't have equanimity when you really need this to happen to be okay, and you really don't want that to happen because it'll be terrible. With equanimity, you go, I think this is worth trying to get to happen. Yeah. Doesn't matter whether it happens or not. It matters that it's worth my time. And if this goes sideways, yeah, it'll be okay. You know, like life's like that. What do we get to learn from that? And so the more that you are comfortable that genuine happiness, equanimity is going to be this real wonderful byproduct. You know, it's like, here's an attitude for equanimity from Thomas Edison. I like his lesson. You know, it's just kind of that famous quote, you know, how do you feel about failing, you know, like 10,000 times, you know, trying to create a light bulb? And Thomas Edison said, I didn't fail 10,000 times. You know, I successfully found 10,000 ways to not make a light bulb. And so the way I look at life is, you know, when things go sideways, like in my own life, I found like a million ways. I'm successful like over a million times on how to not be happy. I know exactly how to do that. I've nailed it over a million times. I have successfully discovered how to not be happy with myself and my life, which all led me to how to be happy. He successfully found all these ways not to make light bulb, to make a light bulb. So our life every day is an opportunity, you know, to learn. And a lot of the lessons is successfully learning what does not work. And I, you know, of course, we had to do it a whole bunch of times. You know, I'm very good at that. Because I really want to learn that this doesn't work. And but that's like nothing to be ashamed of. That's like, okay, I really know this doesn't work anymore. And now I'm going to try something that does. And, you know, and you think about a metaphor for recovery, right? Here's a zinger for you guys. I've been thinking about another book, which is called Stop Doing Things to Get Them Done. And, cause I think that's where we ruin our lives is, when you think about your life, most of your life is doing something, right? But our life's kind of on hold until it's done. Okay. Finally got that done. Well, how long does done last? Like what, a minute, 2 minutes? I don't know. Then you're doing something else, right? And you got to do something else. And it's like all day long, we're doing this to get this stuff done. But our life is doing, right? And now I'm back to chores until it's done. And done doesn't last long. So if we stop doing things to get them done, but start doing them because they're meaningful, now we're actually a participant in how we live most of our life. And so I'm doing something because it's meaningful, whether it's folding clothes, whether it's, you know, again, raking the yard, whatever it is, having to, you know, have that tough conversation with somebody that you didn't want to have, but you're showing up for it. But it's important, and that's why we're doing it. Then what happens is, again, there's no burnout in doing things that are meaningful. When you're interested and want to do something, it's amazing how much energy you have. When something's a chore, we get burnt out. You know, I remember working on cars as an auto mechanic for a while, and, you know, it was, yeah, physical job, and, you know, you get burnt out, a little wore down sometimes. And I was tired, and I was trying to put this transmission in or something. And I was thinking, you know, it's interesting how this sounds so laborious, but I play basketball, man. It's like 10 times, you know, more physical. And I'll run up and down that court and do all that for 2 hours. I'm not tired. And here I am just trying to lift this tranny up, getting tired. And I'm like, the difference is I'm interested in that. And what you're interested in, like when you first chart, you're interested. It's interesting. And now I'm not interested. You know, now it's a chore. If you want, you know, to really have genuine happiness, be interested in what you're doing, not getting it done. And, you know, that's just checking your life off a list, you know?
So I got a question. You know, you've been involved in so much. You've done so much different forms of service, teaching, writing, creating programs. So how do you keep your ego in check and stay rooted in humility?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, you know, it's a good question. Because, you know, for years, I never, I didn't go to conventions. You know, I didn't want to be a speaker. I always hid out in small participation groups. You know, because I used to, you know, I was all judgmental, you know, there's the speaker circuit guy, right? And, you know, and you know, I'd sit there and think, why would they fly somebody in to talk, you know, when there's somebody in the room can talk, you know, like, you know, what's the deal, man? And so literally out of fear, for many years, you know, I never went and did any of that. And, you know, cause what I saw was some people would get their egos really caught up. And then there's a trap, because then you can't be authentic. You can't share when you're suffering. You can't share when you did stuff wrong, you know. And then if you get thousands of people telling you, you know, yeah, you're a pretty good person, man, you start believing it, right? And you, ooh, I'm somebody. And, you know, it's interesting because when I came out of monastic life and I was asked to, I started all my mindfulness and recovery and programs I run, really with old timers asking me to lead 11 step retreats, you know, and then I got asked to speak at some conferences, some conventions, and, you know, spoke at a couple. I've never applied to speak at one. I've always wait till someone asks and then I apply. And, so in Buddhism, as a teacher, so that's another hat I wear. I actually run a Buddhist center and, you know, I'm a Buddhist teacher there. I run mindfulness recovery. That's a day job. And I can't teach unless you ask me. So I'm not hanging a shield saying, you know, yeah, if somebody asks you, you get teaching. So, you know, conventions have been that way as well. And so what you start to understand and what someone once asked me is actually a pretty renowned speaker in the psychology world. It's pretty prominent. And he asked about, you know, get nervous before you speak, maybe at a convention or something, you know, like 1500 people. He said, you know, you get nervous. And I told him, you only get nervous if you're trying to impress them. If you go up there because you want to help them, you won't get nervous. And it did totally change his deal, man. You know, he talks about that at conferences. And that's the difference, right? I'm not sharing anything new. Anything I have to offer is because countless others before me. Anything that I'm here for, if it's not here to help, be helpful, then, you know, there's no need doing it. And if I'm here to impress somebody, I'm on the wrong track, right? There's no genuine, no well-being. And so, so understanding that when you show up, you recognize that you have a life, because we can go back to, you know, a phone call in a hotel lobby in 1935, one alcoholic reaching out to find, you know, someone to help. A guy making that phone call has given me the life I have today, right? And, you know, Jimmy Kay sitting at a meeting when it's looking like it's not going to happen. And he's saying, no, I need to be here for all the addicts who aren't born yet. Okay, we have NA because of these people. So for anyone to sit there and think they're better than anyone else, first off, they don't even understand who they are. It's like everything I have in my life is because of others. The words I'm using now were taught to me. The clothes I wear, countless others have participated. The food I just had, the, you know, everything I have in my life exists because of others. There's not an independent anything about me. I didn't even create my own body. You know, my parents did that. You know, and their grandpa, you know, like everybody has, you know, I'm something that lives independence upon all these others. You know, and there's no independent John you're talking to. There's nothing independent about me. And so once you really understand that, then it's about, okay, you're a part of this thing, and people are making a living, you know, halfway around the world. You know, you have clothes today, and food to eat. Then you start recognizing, wow, this whole program that came out of all these people that went to meetings when they didn't want to go to meetings, and there's a meeting for you when you needed it. That doesn't make you better than anybody. What it does do, though, is make you more fortunate than many. Mm. And you, when you realize you're more fortunate because you have received this help, well, then you're there to be helpful. There's not an ego in gratitude.
I love it. That rolled right into my next question, but yeah, it was all about gratitude. You know, it's all about gratitude. Well, look, I don't want to hold you hostage as much as I would like to, and keep picking your brain. But one thing I do want to ask is where you're at today, and your understanding of some of these things has been gained over a lifetime of experiences and, you know, different challenges that you've been through, and, you know, following the guidance of something greater than you. What do you say to that person who's brand new, who doesn't have that experience, who's just walked in the door, so confused, doesn't know where to go or what to do? What's your message to them?
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, just, I think, needs to be critical, you know, especially as people coming new and into the rooms. And, you know, I have this whole curriculum, mindfulness and recovery, that really supports a 12-step process. And where it starts is, you know, what are your values? You know, what are your values? And when people who are new start discovering they have values, like, it's a game changer. Like, they hadn't thought about their values, hadn't thought about who they want to be. And the message is, you know, in the first section of our curriculum is, you know, you're not broken. You just didn't learn some skills that others have. Let's get back to, do you want to be a good person? Yeah, I want to be a good person. What are your values? These are your values. How would you like us to help you live with those? We can help you with the skills. These steps will empower you. Will empower you to be the person you feel good about being. It's just a matter of some skills, and we're here to help you with that. Do you want to do that? And, you know, it's a pretty tough shot to have them say, no, I don't want to live up to my values. I can't, they'll get. But if you can open that door to let them know that they do have value, and in those first interactions, you know, and one of the first exercises we have is, once you pick your values, what's the time in your life you lived up to it? And they say, oh, I have done this. You know, oh, I have done this. Oh, I have done this. We're so good at beating ourselves up, you know, that we're not very good at recognizing all the good that we have done. And so really bringing the hope, right? I just can't, our NA meeting, it was about that hope, you know, that hopefulness. And you see these examples, but, you know, them seeing you happy is not going to give them hope. You know, them believing they could be happy, that's where you get hope. And so those initial discussions when I sit down with newcomers is really having them tell me about their value. And when they say it out loud, when they see it out loud, they can start to believe that they can actually be that person. And then, you know, you restored to sanity, you know, and I start, how about living a values-based life? Because that'll give you the happiness you've been seeking, you know. And one of the things I do sometimes with a new group, I'm going like a treatment center, new, you know, all these new people. I like to blow their mind a little bit. I'll say, yeah, you know, I've never met an addict that wants to use. And they're like, what? Like, wait, where you been, man? Like, no, man. I mean, granted, I've only been clean 40 years, so I don't know that many addicts. And I haven't met over 8 billion, but I've never met an addict who wants to use. And they're like, what? You know, their heads are getting like, and I said, you know, let me ask you this. What do you really want out of life? What do you really want? You know? And then they'll say things like, I want to be able to look in the mirror. I want to be a good parent. You know, I'd like to have a family someday. I would like to have, you know, self-worth. You know, what do you really want? And they're going, oh, this is what I really want. And he says, okay, well, is using going to get you any of that? Like, no. Okay. And then I say, we confuse desires and habits with what I want. We desire to use. We have compulsions to use. We don't know how not to use. But what do you really want? I've never met an addict that didn't want to use, didn't want to be a prisoner of their addiction. They didn't know how to not use. They had desires to use. They had compulsions to use. And that's a nice opening sometimes, is when they start to realize and change the dialogue. I don't want to use. I just don't know how not to. And you start asking the questions, what do you want? What do you really want? And let's build a path to that life, you know? And so those are some of the shifts, I think, that are really important when people are new, because we got a story, we have a narrative, man. Yeah, it works for other people, not for me. Those people can do stuff I can't. You know, I don't have value, I have shame. And you know, I want to use. And, you know, I'll challenge that question, you know. You really want to use? You know? But the most important thing is really having it be in their dialogue, you know, and asking those questions. And then they get to identify and be very clear about things that they have done well, and start to see some hope.
Awesome. Well, John, man, thank you so much for coming and sharing this time with us. It was so great. You know, it's funny you were talking about, you know, our connection to these electronics or whatever, but you got such a gift, man. Like, I haven't thought about my phone one time since we've been sitting here. So, thank you for that. It was awesome. I mean,
Yeah.
really, I mean, honestly, I haven't. It's been great. I've been engaged the whole time, and that's, yeah, good stuff, man.
All right, now if I could just get my sponsor stop texting while I'm talking to him, that'd be great. Kidding, yeah. Yeah, so that chapter when God walks in, that's my sponsor. And yeah, and then Peter's another brother of mine that we lead 11 step retreats with. So yeah, I'm glad it all gave rise to this. So you guys were reading a chapter, didn't know anything about me or whatever, and then I don't know you guys are reading a chapter, and you know, one day here we are having a conversation. Now there's going to be a bunch of other people listening to this one day. You see how this third step works in our life, man? Like,
It's unreal.
yeah.
It's unreal.
It's unfold. Now I get to know some folks from Tennessee. Yeah, Chase, man,
Yeah.
Tennessee and Chico. Yeah, Oroville, man. I hadn't even thought about that in a little while. And yeah, both of you are Tennessee. You guys both work together?
We do. We
Okay. Sponsor the.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I tell you one last funny story?
Absolutely.
It's because I'm thinking about Tennessee. I'm thinking about this good old boy of West Texas. I work with this treatment center, 12-step mindfulness and recovery-based program in Texas. And you know, I go there once a month, work with clients. And so, yeah, this guy comes up. He's, Miss Bruna, got to tell you, I'm here from West Texas. And I got here this here program, and they started talking about all this here hippy dippy meditation stuff y'all be doing. We don't be doing that here in West Texas. Gotta let you know, Mr. Bruna. And then he goes, but Mr. Bruna, I gotta tell you, it changed my life. That there hippy dippy stuff, turns out, learning how to concentrate and be present made me understand the steps again. Thank you, Mr. Bruno. I mean, it just broke my heart open. But his whole dialogue about we in West Texas, hippy dippy, and all that. I was on the floor, man. And but he shifted, and it was like, whoa. But to hear it in that drawl, it was cool.
Yeah, we hear that story every day.
Yeah.
That same story in some form or fashion, we hear it every day. It's fun
Yeah.
to see that the transition from what he started with to where he go. We get to experience that a lot, and it's really
That's,
beautiful.
it is beautiful, man. Heart opening stuff, man.
In any accent.
Yeah, the Scottish ones are mind blowing. Yeah.
Oh, no doubt.
I can listen to those guys all day.
I still don't understand what accent y'all think we have. I didn't figure that out. Francis mentioned that to me once. I don't know. Still ain't figured out what he's talking about.
Yeah,
Oh.
I got no idea. That's awesome.
They think I have an accent. They
Right. Yeah, we're the ones
could
with the
tell. They
accent.
could tell I'm from California.
Oh, this was great, y'all. I really, yeah, I'm over the moon about it. I'm just tickled. There's a southern word for you, tickled pink.
Tickle pink. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, well, concluding the podcast, just yeah, Francis and Peter, if you guys come in September, Peter and I do that 11th step out in Auburn every year. So you guys come check it out if you're interested.
May just take you up on that.
Yeah. We even have people come from Arkansas once in a while. Yeah.
Oh man. Now, Chase, we've been associated with Arkansas.
Oh boy.
Well, I'm just saying that far away. I
Yeah.
wasn't insinuating anything, I was just saying the distance, Because, they talk funny in Arkansas, not like you guys.
They do a lot of things funny in Arkansas.
Oh,
There's a bunch of good jokes about Arkansas, but that's for another time.
that's another time.
All right,
All right,
well,
you
I'm gonna
guys.
wrap up the podcast and say, hope you enjoyed it, everybody, and we'll be back next week with another episode. We'll see you.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.